Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Greetings, I'm Tricia Cuffer from sunny Key Largo, Florida, your host for New Books in Architecture, a podcast channel on the New Books Network with a special mini-series in landscape architecture. If you have any ideas for books, please send me an email at plantspeoplelove@gmail.com. Today's book is Desert Paradises, Surveying the Landscapes of Dubai's Urban Model by Julian Bolliter, published by Routledge in 2019. Hi, Julian. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Tricia.
So let's start with, can you tell the audience about yourself?
Yeah, okay. So I'm co-director of the Australian Urban Design Research Centre in Perth, which is a research centre of the University of Western Australia. And we're interested in the big issues facing cities in this century.
And what is your academic background?
So my academic background is I did an undergraduate of landscape architecture last century at the University of Western Australia, graduated. I worked as a landscape architect all around the world in Sydney, Dubai, London and Boston briefly at Martha Schwartz Partners. And then I returned back to Perth and did a PhD with Richard Weller, who's now from the heading up the landscape architecture practice, program at the University of Pennsylvania. And the PhD I did was on Dubai and landscape architecture in particular in Dubai. And that formed the basis of this book.
Well, that's my next question. So what was your motivation for writing this book? Why Dubai?
Look, I moved to Dubai in 2005 to practice as a landscape architect with extraordinarily little knowledge of the culture that I was moving into and the landscape and all the issues that go with design landscapes in that part of the world. I was completely naive of these issues. Practice there was such a exercise in just surviving the day-to-day and delivering, you know, massive projects very quickly and really didn't leave a lot of time for reflection on practice. So when I left Dubai some 2 years later, I felt that there were a lot of unresolved issues for me and things I wanted to contemplate further. And the PhD sort of seemed to provide the perfect opportunity for exploring some of the issues which practice hadn't allowed me to really think about fully.
What were some of the issues that you explored in your PhD? What are the issues of Dubai?
Look, the PhD was a kind of evaluative exercise, which really just set out and tried to understand what is the United Nations, what is IFLA telling landscape architects they should be doing in these kind of contexts. And it was really about analysing contemporary practice in Dubai in relation to that framework, assessment framework we'd set up, which related back to the International Federation of Landscape Architecture and the United Nations, and really just trying to assess practice against those. Now, that has its problems because that's a sort of Western normative framework. I guess it's being set up and used to guide the analysis, but at least it gives you some framework for critically analysing the sort of practice which has been undertaken in Dubai.
Can you tell me more, a little bit about, of course, I got my master's degree in landscape architecture. We studied Islamic landscapes. What is an idealized Islamic landscape? How is it different from Western culture? Can you talk more about it?
Yeah, I mean, there's a tradition of recreating paradise, which is strong in both cultures, the idea of a paradise garden, which typically in the Middle East broadly, or in Arabic Islamic urbanism, tends to be a very where landscape or green landscape becomes a precious jewel, which is typically sort of inscribed within a courtyard sort of dwelling where it's protected, and it becomes this recreation of paradise of greenness and of flowing water and repose. And this kind of paradisical landscape is somewhat, I guess, is a theme in both cultures, but it's particularly pronounced in the Middle East, where the backdrop of it is so arid and so much a desert.
So why did they, what's the history of Dubai? I'm not even sure myself. How did they choose this location? How did this all get started?
Yeah, so Dubai was like many small centres along the Trucial Coast, as it was called, which is essentially the coastline of the Arabian Gulf, which were small fishing settlements, essentially, perched on the edge of the Rub al Khali Desert, which is the empty quarter in English. And they were, for a long time, very small and comparatively, you know, to the larger region, insignificant kind of centres. They were trading centres. And they had been there for some time. There's evidence of, you know, Dubai or that area having been settled for thousands of years in a modest kind of way. So there is a long history to those centres, but they were typically small. And they were essentially fishing and trading kind of ports with some smuggling, which has been a kind of a long tradition in Dubai. So things were very quiet there. They became protectorates of the British in the, I believe it was the 19th and, or yeah, in the 19th century. So they kind of signed their protection away to the British. But really there wasn't a lot to report, I suppose, until the discovery of oil, which was typically at the sort of mid-20th century, where things changed quite rapidly, as you can imagine, with the discovery of sometimes vast oil reserves in what became the Emirate of Abu Dhabi, and to some degree Dubai, enabled a campaign of modernization to be unleashed quite quickly. So there are enormous changes in the culture which occurred in those in the decades that ensued after finding oil and having that resource tapped. So you go from a situation where there are goats and camels, you know, wandering through the main street of what became Dubai, and to the first, you know, concrete blockhouse being built, the expansion of the dry docks, the early sheikh of Dubai, Sheikh Zayed and Sheikh Rashid, who followed, were visionary figures who very much seized the opportunity to modernize their emirate, what became the Emirate of Dubai. So that, this was things like building road infrastructure, building concrete housing, expanding ports and building ports, starting to build things like dry docks. So in Dubai they built the largest dry docks in the Middle East, so ships could be built and reconditioned and repaired. And so there was tremendous investment in modernization, which saw a huge upheaval in how people lived. And it went from a fairly handicrafts kind of economy to one which was then sort of geared around the production of oil. And then we saw enormous changes wrought to the urban form, going from fairly organic and informal sort of settlements to your kind of concrete block housing, which started to resemble quite quickly more suburban layouts, which would be more familiar to you, your American and Australian listeners. And then... Yes, I could go on and on, but that was
no, please go.
Phase of change.
So they, how fast did this happen? Because I never heard of Dubai, and then all of a sudden it was in the news. I guess they were doing marketing. And do they still do, just out of curiosity, oil production close to the city? Is it far away from the city? How did they? What is their urban form? How did they do it?
Yeah.
What are they doing?
Look, the urban form is very much based on Western principles. The early plans of Dubai basically extrapolated the road system out into the desert and along the coast in all directions. And it assumed what would be fairly recognisable to most suburban dwellers of the Western world, which is detached concrete housing on a generous road system with fairly generous open space and green space. with the backdrop of the desert, of course. What really, I think, started to change, though, which was in the 1990s and certainly very early 2000s, was an understanding by the rulers of Dubai, which at that point was Sheikh Mohammed, which was a realization that while Dubai had had a lot of oil, that its economy wasn't going to be able to ride on the back of the oil forever. And certainly oil reserves were starting to be diminished. And there was a realization that they needed to seize other ways of firing the economy up and keeping things ticking along. Basically, that saw a real easing up of the constraints on Westerners and outsiders being able to buy real estate in Dubai. So up until that point, there'd been fairly significant restrictions on that. But you started to see the development of free trade zones and also zones which Westerners could buy property. There was also an increasing concern with actually having Dubai feature in the kind of, you know, global consciousness. And this was done in very, I think the rulers of Dubai were very intelligent about the way they went around this. They basically conceded that Dubai had very little in the way of natural attractions. I mean, it had the desert and it had the beach. And they had certainly their own charms, but it wasn't going to put elevate Dubai onto the global stage. So for them, it was about actually constructing attractions. So this was about things like building the Palms, which some people will know, which were huge urban developments which extend out into the shallow and warm waters of the Arabian Gulf, which look like palms when viewed from an orbiting satellite. It was about projects like the Burj Dubai, or it became the Burj Khalifa, which is still the tallest building in the world. And it was about building projects which would capture the global attention through constructed attractions. So they did this probably more successful than in any ruler or government has done today. They put Dubai on the map, and to the point where people would say London, New York, Paris, Dubai. The fact that Dubai had been elevated to being into that sort of class of global city was an amazing achievement, given that in the 1970s, Dubai was really a few dusty streets and not much else other than a small port. So an enormous achievement, which was, funnily enough, the idea that constructed achievements could introduce Dubai to the world was something that I believe it to be Sheikh Zayed or Sheikh Rashid in the 1970s or 60s realized when Princess Elizabeth deviated a flight she was taking from Bahrain back to London to see the then tallest building in the Middle East, the World Trade Center, which the Dubai government had just built on Sheikh Zayed Road, which was at that point the tallest building in Dubai. And I think there was a realization then that you could construct attractions and the outside world would notice. So that really informed Dubai's urban development into the 90s and early 2000s. We then see another shift which occurs, which is, I think, a timely shift, which has been more or less probably the last 10 years or so, which I think it's probably emerged out of the sometimes stinging critique which is made of Dubai, which is it's all show, but it's really very vacuous and it's superficial. And sure, they've built a tall building and they've built these crazy megastructures in the form of palms out into the Arabian Gulf. The realization that it might be more about providing enriching experience and diverse experiences which tourists won't receive anywhere else. So there's been a real focus in the last few years by Sheikh Mohammed, the current ruler of Dubai, into constructing experience. There's a lot of place making and place branding going on. There's a lot of development of urban developments which are which actually artificially try and recreate a sort of vernacular of the region. So they actually try and recreate to some degree what was there prior to the petroleum era of Dubai. So we have these sort of nostalgic developments, which are about trying to deliver, I think, for the wealthy investor and the global tourist, and to some degree wealthy locals, trying to deliver a kind of a built form vernacular, which may or may not have ever really existed there. But nonetheless, it seemed to be giving a unique experience, which you won't get elsewhere in the world. So it's very much about become about actually trying to deliver experience rather than just now building the world's tallest building or the biggest mega structure.
Oh, well, that's one question I would ask you about. I saw in a book you said that Dubai is an open air canvas for art and culture. As a Westerner, you know, when I travel, I like to go places and experience something different than where I was back home. How are they incorporating and maybe even educating the tourists about their Islamic culture?
Yeah, look, I think it is about trying to rebuild these urbanisms which evoke traditional Emirati culture. And I think that works to some degree. However, it tends to be more of a retail destination, which is kind of themed in a certain way, but it's still very much about getting people to open their wallets. Look, I mean, they have been pushing national culture quite heavily in the Arabian Gulf and in Dubai and the United Emirates in particular. I think in recent years for a couple of reasons. One was I think there was a perception from some Emiratis, and this is probably better said by them than me, that Dubai had been too open to the outside world and too quick to modernize and had lost its sense of who it was and its unique sense of identity and its traditional culture. So there's very much in school curriculums and the like, there's very much a strong push to reclaim national identity and heritage, which is coming from the highest levels in the UAE government. And look, I think that's understandable for Emiratis who might have feel like they've lost the kind of quieter and more authentic city of their childhoods to really what has been an unparalleled period of globalization. So there is that going on. In terms of how it might inform the tourist, I think Dubai has been good in terms of there's a particular mosque, Jumeirah Mosque, which is open to Westerners to come in and have a first-hand experience of Islamic culture and prayer. And certainly there's a host of museum projects which have been constructed across the UAE, which are really dedicated to being able to communicate the story of the fact that Dubai is not a recent. It might have emerged into the global consciousness quite recently, but it's been around for a long time. And some would say it's been around as long as the earliest settlement in the Fertile Crescent. So it is, in some respects, truly ancient. So there's been a desire by the UAE government to make that claim. But Dubai, at the same time, is very it's very successful in that it allows a very multicultural community of people to live essentially their own way of life. It hasn't demanded assimilation of Westerners or really any real expatriates to any large degree. It is what Mali Andreas refers to as island urbanism, which is it is islands of fairly discrete cultural blocks which don't tend to mix that much. So from one perspective, it's a tremendously successful multicultural society. In fact, it's some 80%. Immigrants, foreigners, expatriates, and it's only 20% locals in Dubai. But it's generally peaceful and it generally works in a fairly harmonious kind of way. A critic would say, however, that it tends to not be that much interaction between the different sociocultural strata in Dubai, which, frankly, from an Emirati perspective is quite understandable. If you've seen your culture overwhelmed by, proportionally 80% of foreigners, I think you can understand why there might be a withdrawal from that. But long story short, I think the Dubai government is trying to educate tourists to some degree and expatriates to some degree, but it's careful not to be too demanding in that respect as well and to allow people to really follow their own way of life in what is essentially a foreign city.
Well, since we were into landscape architecture too, and you talked a little bit in your book about ecology, you said they had a lot of generous green spaces, but what about the ecology of the desert? That's pretty interesting. How did they incorporate it, or did they, what did they do?
Yeah, look, if you read Sheikh Mohammed's book, there's a sense that the desert is essentially an empty place, which needs to be transformed for development, and it needs to be greened. And so often in the Dubai municipality kind of planning for green space, there's a lot of comparison to what's going on in the rest of the world and the fact that kind of pushing this idea that Dubai needs to keep up. So if the rest of the world is trying to achieve 10% public open space per urban area, then Dubai should achieve 12%. So the turning the desert green is generally seen as being something to aspire to. Now, there's a couple of reasons for that. I mean, I get into kind of somewhat shaky territory here because I'm not Emirati and I can't speak with complete authority, but there is a lot of anecdotal evidence to suggest that the act of turning the desert green, generally through urban development, is to some degree quite pragmatic, which is, well, the green packaging of real estate developments certainly improves their saleability and their real estate value. But there's another angle to it, which some scholars have pointed to, which is that the Quran refers to not just the idea of aspiring to reach paradise, but also to recreating it on earth. And certainly there is that tradition in Arabic Islamic paradise gardening. But in Dubai, you have the situation where oil has been discovered and all of a sudden there are desalination plants. And there is the sheikh has the power and developers have the power to turn large swathes of the desert green. Now, there is some evidence to suggest that that is, to some degree, a recreation of paradise. Now, it might not be a dominant component of why that's being done, but it's probably in the mix. And that has a lot of implications for a benevolent dictator like Sheikh Mohammed, which is, as you turn the desert green, you're confirming both that you're a very strong ruler because you can turn the desert green. This is no small thing in a hyper-arid climate and context like Dubai is. So it both reinforces the strength of the sheikh, of this benevolent dictator, but also gives him a kind of religious imprimatur, which is he is recreating paradise. Now, for someone who's not elected and is to some degree a benevolent dictator who maintains his authority by being benevolent and performing the works of God and providing this wonderful green space, this is not an insignificant act to be doing this. So the act of turning the desert green has these kind of political and, you know, religious dimensions to it and very pragmatic dimensions, like flogging real estate. But in the kind of frenzy to turn the desert green, often the concerns of biodiversity and wildlife have kind of been trampled. Now, that in itself is quite understandable because the biodiversity in Dubai is quite thin. It is it's a hyper-arid kind of context. I lived there for 2 years and it rained once. So it's not to say there's not desert ecology. There is, and it's not to be, it shouldn't be written off, but it's understandable how in this frenetic application of green space, it's sometimes been overlooked. But we're finding in more recent years, obviously, landscape architects are sensitive, or often sensitive to local context. And there's an increasing kind of push to try and get endemic planting into projects. But it's not easy because developers are trying to market a certain image. And the image of kind of weedy sort of desert plants is not necessarily the image which can be used to sell real estate developments. So it's not easy for a well-meaning landscape architect to deliver an endemic landscape in Dubai, because it can be seen like, well, when are you going to install the real landscape? The other thing is just often these plants are just not available in commercial quantities. So there's a whole industry that needs to be built up around endemic planting. So no easy feat, but some landscape architects like Desert Inc. are certainly, and amongst others, are pushing that sort of development.
Well, I'm curious, how did their urban form and your research of it, how did they get, this is kind of an obvious question, how did they get their water to support such a large city? That's a lot of infrastructure.
Yeah, it is a lot of infrastructure. Look, initially there was a lot of groundwater pumping and the UAE generally, the United Arab Emirates, which is the confederation of Arab states that Dubai and the Emirate of Dubai is part of, have certainly been over-extracting their groundwater. So there's been a lot of pumping going on, but most of it's from desalination plants, which are principally fossil fuel powered in Dubai's case, running on oil, which, you know, produce a tremendous amount of fresh water. And without that, Dubai would not exist in its current form. But, you know, obviously that does come at an ecological cost. returning all the salt to the Arabian Gulf, according to some commentators, has made it even more saline than it already has and or that it already is. And that's led to some fish kills. And obviously there's, you know, greenhouse gas emissions associated with an oil-fired power, you know, desalination plant. But that's basically enabled this kind of green, sprawling pancake of urban form that comprises Dubai.
Well, I know we've gotten into the conversation before I asked this question, but what was your research methods for this book?
Yeah.
How'd you approach it?
How I approached it was this. Look, the book has a couple of different sections to it. So let me recreate it in my mind. Look, a lot of the book is interpretive. So it's a lot of the book is about really trying to understand the dynamics of the kind of landscape and urban design which is being produced in Dubai. What are the agendas behind it? Some of the agendas behind urban development in Dubai are very transparent, which is that it is to make money, like urban development around the world. And it's about sustaining Dubai's economy, which is completely legitimate. So, you know, there's an economic agenda going on. There's a political agenda going on too. I think the way we've been talking about green landscapes as some kind of recreation of paradise does legitimize the rule of Sheikh Mohammed, a benevolent dictator. There's also a political dimension and a cultural dimension going on with these recreation of apparently vernacular urban forms. You have to understand as the Arab Spring swept across the Middle East, there was concern, understandably, from the benevolent kind of dictators of the Arabian Gulf that this turmoil would engulf their own states. And I do believe that the creation of these vernacular historic or apparently historic urban developments is a way of positioning their rule within a larger, a longer lineage, which extends back to the ancient kind of origins of cities like Dubai. So I think there's a political dimension to it that's going on. So, look, the book was about kind of trying to unearth some of these different narratives and agendas, which otherwise might not have been transparent to or apparent to a kind of naive practitioner like myself when I was working in Dubai and more concerned with not making major mistakes on building sites rather than sort of, you know, unpicking what things might mean. The early sections are interpretive. Now, they use a few different devices to arrive at that sort of interpretation. So, you know, there's a comprehensive literature review that was undertaken. There was a series of interviews which were undertaken. And also a really close reading of you know, Sheikh Mohammed's book to try and understand, you know, for a city and an emirate which is so much determined by the vision of one man, at least currently, to be able to really get into as much as I could to try and understand his perspective and where he was coming from. So the early book sections of the book are very interpretive. It then switches into a more evaluative mode where it really just looks at, you know, from the United Nations perspective, and the Sustainable Development Goals perspective and the International Federation of Landscape Architecture, are the kind of landscapes and urban designs we're delivering in Dubai, are they successful in meeting those aspirations which that framework sort of sets up? Now, there's problems in that because that's a very Western framework and the book has been criticised because of that. But you have to understand that the Dubai's urban development model is tremendously influential across the region, to Asia to some degree, and particularly in Africa. Dubai is sort of seen as the kind of grandparent of new African smart cities because they took a city that really had very little, you know. It was a desert, and they turned it into a city that would be mentioned alongside Paris, London, and New York. And there's always a sense of what can be done in Dubai. Well, maybe it can be done in Uganda. Maybe it can be done in Somalia. So it's tremendously influential, hence the fact that there was a recourse to the Sustainable Development Goals of the UN and IFLA to just go, is this practice meeting our aspirations globally? And on many fronts, it's not. And so the book discusses that. It is not, Dubai has one of the highest per capita greenhouse gas emission or ecological footprints of any city on the planet. And, you know, huge sprawling green landscapes which require vast amounts of fertilizer and water and produce a city which requires a car to navigate, obviously are implicated in the huge ecological footprint per capita that Dubai has. So from an environmental perspective, it's problematic. It has also seen the erasure of desert, you know, ecology and also aquatic ecology. You know, the palms which are built off Dubai saw the destruction of huge amounts of coral which would wash up on the beach when I lived there every day. So, you know, there's a kind of courageousness to Dubai development, which is impressive. And you know, I you can be swept away by that, but it has to be conceded that the environmental effects of it have been significant. Now, the other things which the UN and IFLA say we should aspire to is inclusive urban forms and green space, and Dubai isn't that inclusive. It's tremendously stratified in terms of different sociocultural groups, which extend from very wealthy emirates through to wealthy expatriates through to a kind of unskilled migrant underclass who build the city but don't really get to inhabit it. Now, we see in Dubai often public spaces being fenced because they're viewed as being primarily for families and particularly for Emiratis, which is understandable. And many of the kind of urban spaces which are heavily themed and stylized and branded really are for trapping capital and for producing unique but fairly indulgent experiences for locals and tourists and wealthy tourists and expats. So the city is not particularly inclusive from a societal perspective, which is another thing which the UN and the International Federation of Landscape Architects say we should aspire to. And finally, culturally, what really does tend to happen in Dubai is that the local built form vernacular is kind of reconstituted and themed and starts to emerge in forms which are actually pretty different to what was there. So there's a kind of, there can be argued to be a trivialization of traditional Emirati culture and a trivialization of the vernacular built form into something which kind of looks a bit vernacular, a bit local, but actually the kind of authentic forces that would have originally produced that urbanism have completely moved on. And the urbanisms which have been created, which are actually often quite charming, these sort of fictional arabesque kind of urbanisms, can be quite charming and fun to visit, but they're not very authentic. And they can be argued to commodify and trivialize the actual built form vernacular. So by way of summary, when you look at what the UN and IFLA say you should be doing as a design practitioner, Dubai doesn't really stack up very well on either of those three fronts. But I hope the book is complex enough to say there are quite understandable reasons why these things are happening. And it doesn't mean practitioners just don't care. It doesn't mean the Sheikh is evil. It doesn't mean it's all some grand conspiracy. It just means it's really difficult in that context to deliver those aspirations. And certainly as a practitioner in Dubai, I think I failed on all fronts. And that didn't mean I didn't care. I was just generally very ignorant, I think. And also your focus is elsewhere when you're, you know, in the middle of a building boom and you're just trying to get things built properly. It's very difficult to indulge those more academic dimensions of practice. And I hope the full complexity of that situation comes through in the book and practitioners who are genuinely trying to do their best and not offended by these negative characterizations.
No, I could see. I mean, that is, I mean, the fact that he was able to do that and to lift his culture into prosperity, that's an amazing achievement.
It's a huge achievement.
And like you said, you know, I mean, I was thinking about where you're talking. It's like, you know, none of us could do anything perfect. And, you know, I was thinking about, I self-critique my own stuff. Until it's built, you can't sit back and go, well, did I do it well or not? And I'm okay with that because to me, critique is making things better. It's not being negative. It's how can I make it better? Because I always like to make things better.
Look, and I think Dubai is at the right point in its, you know, in its evolution where it probably could do with some targeted critique. The problem with Dubai is you tend to there's a kind of fashion in the Western media to bash Dubai because it's very easy. And so reporters jet in and don't barely get out of the airport and slag the place off and leave again. And I really don't want to perpetuate that model of critique with Dubai because I think it is actually very unfair. And I think what not just Sheikh Mohammed has achieved, but, you know, the succession of sheikhs who run Dubai have achieved is staggering. I mean, they've put that place in the map. The thing is, all of these achievements come with trade-offs. And I think if the book communicates anything, it's just that there are significant trade-offs which go with that kind of courageous and sometimes reckless sort of urbanization, which is you build a mega structure you can see from space and it looks like a giant palm and everyone sees it on Google Earth and puts Dubai on the map. That's a huge achievement. But on the other hand, you're destroying coral reefs and you're also, they might be quite wealthy, but you're also embedding people and expecting them to live part of their lives in an urban form which is really not well suited to everyday existence. It's not easy to get around. It's not walkable. It's very difficult to be sustainable living when you're living on a, you know, a rock and sand filled megastructure extending 8 kilometres into the water, you know. So there are all these trade-offs, and I hope the book is nuanced enough to be able to evaluate or to at least discuss these trade-offs, which are inherent in any of the planning which has underpinned Dubai's, you know, amazing growth over the last few decades.
Well, that kind of reminded me, you know, I live in Key Largo and, you know, it's not walkable. Its economy is not sustainable either. And I could make a lot of the same critiques of this area.
Yeah, indeed. And perhaps you should, you know, I mean, it's, if it's valid in Dubai, it's valid in Key Largo. However, the thing we have to be wary of is this, there is this culture of Dubai bashing. And henceforth, when I critique Dubai in the book, it wasn't a case of just wandering in there and just getting the knife into it. This is why I think it's important to be using a framework such as set up by the UN or IFLA so that you have some kind of verifiable kind of framework by which you're making the critique. It's not just happening on an intuitive or impulsive or ideological basis, you know, because I think that is damaging and that doesn't really achieve anything and that's going to alienate a lot of people and probably quite rightly.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's still, an accomplishment and how this discovery of oil just completely transformed everything they had overnight. That must have been kind of jarring culturally.
Yeah, it's a huge shift. I think, again, it's a story of trade-offs, isn't it? I mean, with that Emiratis sort of emerge into the global stage and there's a whole bunch of, you know, I think... You know, the reputation and the prestige and the wealth and the luxury that goes with that must have been intoxicating. And, you know, and the green space and this verdant kind of city which formed for a culture which had been essentially living in the desert for a millennia. You know, this huge expanse in green space, this kind of green paradise that formed, it would have been intoxicating, particularly for the Bedouin who, you know, who were living in the desert, where greenery was about life and death, where such their sensitivity to rainfall would be that they would remember that in that part of the desert, it had rained 1 year earlier or 1 year later than other parts, and henceforth would be just that slight bit more green. And that would mean that the camels would be able to survive and they would be able to survive. So for a culture that's been living with that kind of relative deprivation to have suddenly had this huge influx of oil-generated revenue by which you start to transform, you know, what becomes a city into this kind of green paradise would have been absolutely intoxicating. So you have that on one hand, but then this, you know, what must have been this jarring kind of dislocation from traditional life being thrust into the kind of global spotlight, even though probably a lot of Emiratis didn't really seek that. Having your city kind of completely subsumed by outsiders and foreigners must have been pretty difficult as well. And I'm sure there's Emiratis who, at the end of it all, really would ask, why is this being done in our name? Did we really ever want this? And I think as people, and particularly Emiratis, have asked that question, the Sheikh is sensitive to that. And I think the kind of push to reinforce national culture through the curriculum, through the construction of museums and galleries, through the construction of apparently vernacular urbanisms, I think is his way of recognising that there has been a tremendous trade-off for Emirati people. And, you know, I for one don't envy them, but it's not for me to really say, you know, it's their country and they will make the trade-offs they make.
So what's the biggest lesson that you learned in all this research? I'll give you a minute. I'll throw you a curveball.
Yeah, that's a good question. I just think that it's these, and I hope the book is nuanced enough to make this point well. These things are incredibly complicated. I spent, between doing the PhD and finishing the book was 10 years, and Dubai still remains somewhat enigmatic to me, which is, it's kind of like Dubai can be viewed from any number of different lenses or angles. And it can be argued to be an abomination, and it can be argued to be a wonderful achievement. So after 10 years of studying the city, it still scrambles my brain a bit. So I think the overwhelming takeaway for me is it's bloody complicated, and that it takes a long time to be really able to unpick all the agendas and the narrative that urbanism and landscape, urban and landscape design in that part of the world embody. And so we should be very cautious before we crash in there, thinking we know it all, frankly, like I did. And that it kind of, you know, the condescending attitude I had to that part of the world and the kind of rapid, you know, the rapidly forming belief I had that it was just a sandpit that could passively absorb my own kind of works of art, it's really naive. And I think the book has been, the PhD for me has been somewhat of a humbling experience in the sense that I still don't really know. It's still quite complex. And my take on the work I did and the work others do shifts quite dramatically from day to day and week and month to month. So it's a complex place. It's a hall of mirrors, and we should not stumble into those landscape lightly, and we should certainly do it with a lot of humility, which I think a lot of practitioners do, frankly. Perhaps I'm not typical of them. And I think the culture of design is improving. I think the culture of being aware that Emirati culture has something that the Westerners might not have too, and something that is worth spending the time to learn from, is also something which is, I think, more widespread than when I worked there in 2005. So I think things are emerging and improving. But in summary to your very, you know, difficult question, it's really complicated. And I hope the book just opens a little door to some of that complexity, and helps to kind of shed some light. It's certainly not the Bible though, and I think there's room for contention of points made, and I'm certainly open to that and not offended by that.
Well, I was also thinking a little bit earlier too about, I've always loved geometry, and to me, the Islamic artwork, the geometry and how they put it all together, it's just, it's stunning.
Mm. Mm.
And I think it's just such in essence, a beautiful culture in that type of art, et cetera. And I'll go back a little bit. Are they incorporating any of their art maybe back into it? Are they starting to think that maybe they're building, it sounds like they're starting to build their culture back into this form.
Yeah, they are. And look, this sort of arabesque geometries are crop up all over the place in Dubai now. Projects tend to either, particularly urban projects where you'd kind of see that stuff, they tend to either be very retro, and they do try and evoke that for vernacular, and often that's done through these kind of arabesque geometries, and that's fine. On the other hand, you do get urban spaces which just aspire to being completely global and to be cool and minimalist and to be very much sleek and of a global aesthetic. So you find both, but certainly the kind of geometries you're talking about are cropping up all over the place. As you'd expect, they're beautiful things, and they provide a springboard for a designer to kind of to produce something that does feel to some degree like it belongs, but you quickly get subsumed in quite complex issues, which is you're a Westerner sort of taking these geometries without a lot of understanding of perhaps what they might signify or indeed how they historically how they evolved, and it's starting to be recreated as a pastiche. But maybe I'm just being an academic and overcomplicating things, which shouldn't be overcomplicated. They're a nice pattern and you do see them all over the place.
Well, I guess at the end it sounds like that urban form is just complicated.
It's complicated. I should have called the book "It's Complicated." But I don't know if it would have sold. People aren't often that into complexity. The world tends to be full of it already, I think.
It's been a really insight, and their relationship to water, and their point of view and their aspirations. It's a great book. And I know we've taken up a lot of your time today, and it's late there in Australia. Can you tell our audience what fun projects are you working on now?
Yeah, it's been a bit of a shift of gears since the Dubai book. So there's plenty of problems in Australia, so I'm turning my focus back to Australia where I live, and actually working at a whole different scale. We're working on Australia has got a population projection which is credible, that it will double in population by mid-century and triple by the end of the century. And there's a kind of a push in Australia to develop a national settlement plan, which brings together this fragmented mess of different scales of planning which Australia has and binds it together with one overarching plan that would rule them all. And so that is something we're working on at the moment in terms of doing community surveys to try and understand how would Australians like to see Australia grow? Is it about big cities in the north, new cities in the south? Is it about renovating, expanding existing cities? Is it about decentralizing into smaller cities in the regions? We've never had any comprehensive kind of surveying of the Australian people for them to tell us how this country should urbanize in the 21st century. So I'm really excited about that. That's what we're working on at the moment. It's highly visual work and it's engaging work, and it's of a scale that gets you out of bed in the morning. So I'm enjoying that immensely and missing my mental trips to the Middle East, but realizing that it was probably also time to move on.
Oh, but that sounds fascinating. You'll have to keep us up to date on your next book, maybe about Australia.
For sure, I'd love to, and I will keep you in the loop.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And again, this book is Desert Paradises, Surveying the Landscapes of Dubai's Urban Model, published by Routledge in 2019 by Julian Bulliter. Did I say that right?
No, Bulliter. But
Bulliter.
It's okay.
I'll get it right. And again, this has been Tricia Keffer, your host on New Books and Architecture, a podcast channel in the New Books Network. If you have any ideas for books, please send me an email at plantspeoplelove@gmail.com. Thank you so much.